Okay, I just handed out, this is the mailing list, and on some of these, you can see like it says down there, it says commission, subcommission members, so that's about 20 people there, and we mailed 3 copies to each bar association, and I think there was 10 copies to public defender's office, because they distributed them themselves. And we sent some to libraries and such. Go ahead, Fred, one of them. Yeah, well, this doesn't have legislators on here. So, but that's the standing mailing list, so anybody you want added, just give us the name. Okay, we're on to...
S, Denise O'Steen.
Oh, well, this was... What's it?
Name S, Denise O'Steen.
I think you have Senator Joseph Barcini one.
Okay, we're going to start on page 52 on kidnapping here. Captain Barkley.
Yep.
It's from General Police Department. If you'd like to say anything on the provision, sit right here. So, somewhat informal.
And Jim Barkley.
I might say chief, not captain.
Oh, that's why I asked. I wasn't.
Jim Barkley, Chief of Police Juneau. I'm appearing here, though, as the president of the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, not as a representative of the city of Rowe, Juneau government. And I primarily wanted to come here to express my hopefulness that this thing will go through pretty much as it is. It's one of the best revisions in my estimation, in my opinion, that I've seen undertaken in the criminal codes. Aside from one or two minor questions I had in it, of which 2 or 3 Mr. Starnes answered. I've discussed it with several other individuals in law enforcement, heads of departments. They're pretty thoroughly convinced that we can live with this. We all recognize that until it gets into operation and that there might be some little area that isn't covered here and there. We're very, very happy with this. It seems to answer a lot of the problems that exist under current laws, where everybody wonders what you can do after you've arrested somebody. Everybody, even right down to and including district attorneys, and I'm sure Dan Hickey can tell you that. Yeah, he broke the law, but we don't know just exactly which one he broke right at the moment. And I think this will solve a lot of it. One of the areas of concern in here to me, and it's the only one that I can find, and I would hope that there are not too many of them, is page 70-71. I know when you get into the sexual crimes, you're kind of in a political arena. But it appears, the way I read this, that it might be wise under section 430 and 440 to specifically set out there what you've indicated in your narrative, that you intend these to apply to those individuals, the victim, between the age of 13 and 60. Because it appears to me what can happen is if you get a person over here under 13, a victim under 13, you have an either or. What do? We can charge them with a Class A, or we can charge them with a Class B, or we can charge them with a Class C. Or, if the defendant is the right age, we can go to a misdemeanor. There's just all kinds of room for dealing and wheeling, and if you're trying to get out the personal opinion and feeling of the individuals involved, I don't think you've done it in this particular instance. And that really is the only thing in here that I had any question about, other than some other words which Mr. Starnes indicates that those that know how to draft legislation is covered. But aside from that, we're very, very happy with it. I hate to see some of the guns that are beginning to be opposed to it raising their ugly head, because I've seen some of the tentative drafts that have come up before. And
it was a mess a year ago.
Even from a non-lawyer standpoint, it was some of the ones that have come up before. You know, you just sit there and just shoot a full of holes, and you ask a lawyer what it means, and they don't know. And some of the other drafts that have come up, they didn't know what would happen. I'm sure Dan can tell you about some of those. Even a dummy like me can read it, pretty well understand what you can do and what you can't do. I even went so far as to take this home to my wife. She's pretty near as dumb as I am, and she could pretty well understand.
Mr. Chairman, for the record,
you could do it.
I can say that I personally know that not to be the case.
He's for the record, I'm going to send Lois a tape of this.
It's not too often that I come before one of these committees and rave this much about something that's been done.
This is only the first book, though, Chief.
Well, I'm aware of that, and I'm quite pleased with what's come out of a committee, because usually it's a hodgepodge of everything, and this appears to me to be very, very comprehensive, and I'm extremely pleased with it, and I would hate to see it shot all apart. Got my support any way you could use it.
And who did you say you're speaking for, Jim?
Last Association of Chiefs of Police.
Okay.
Mr. Brown.
Well, then the criticism you are raising then relating to those sexual offenses is you think there might be too much discretion in the event that there's a victim under 13 of a sexual assault in the third or fourth degree, in that the offender could be charged with too many different crimes at the discretion of the prosecutors.
Yeah, there's the possibilities run clear from a Class A, clear down to a misdemeanor. Those possibilities exist, and it depends entirely upon the prosecutor as to what happens. For that matter, I guess it even depends upon perhaps the policeman of what he arrests him for. Generally, if the policeman arrests him for one of the lesser offenses, you don't too often see even the district attorneys jacking it up unless it's a flagrant case.
I wanted to ask, I think Tim and I discussed this before we came in here, might get Brown to take a look on page 70, line 20. Being any age engages in sexual contact with another person under 13 years of age. What if this little boy is 12 or 13?
It goes to juvenile court.
Yeah, but I mean, did he commit a Class C offense if a 12 and being of any age?
A juvenile can't commit an offense, so to speak, I guess. Is that right, Dan?
Not unless he'd be waived to adult jurisdiction.
Right. Pretty likely for a 12-year-old.
He commits a delinquent act, if you will. Yeah.
So you don't get the doctor and nurse situation where they're going to go for a class A.
Well, I'll use it. I'll let you see mine. I'll use the doctor and nurse.
As a 13-year-old girl, you're arrested for contributing to the...
If it's okay with the committee, we've got to understand what Chief Barkley, from he's pointed out in the sexual assault section,
I was going to say that, leaving out that 13, it was never considered, you know, in terms of the giving the prosecution too much discretion there. That issue was never brought up.
Okay, well, let's bring that issue up tomorrow when we're going through the whole thing. We can bring it up along with any other questions, and we'll examine that. We appreciate any, you know, any specific comments you have on this, other drafts coming out, too.
Terry, did you get a letter from Joan Katz about the sixth section?
I've got... I didn't get it from Joan Katz.
We've got a number of letters.
We've gotten a number of letters. They seem to be on the same particular point of spousal immunity.
I received a letter, and I'm just trying to remember. I don't even think Joan signed it. I think somebody else signed it, maybe. From the women's... Oh, yeah, from the women's group in Anchorage called Awake. Jackie Grace.
I've received several letters that I turned over to Barry to research to see what their problem was, and I think they were all in spousal immunity.
Yeah, the letters, I think we had three or four, they all approved of our degree structure and how we defined without consent. The only problem was with the spousal immunity.
I think what basically they were saying is that they thought there was a lot of improvement, but they wanted it to go a little bit further on this one item of spousal immunity. And,
I wanted to check that out, because I won't be able to be here for the whole session.
Yeah, well, we can always bring it up at some point later, too. And I intend to do that on any question that somebody raises, you know, later on. Just because we had a hearing and gone over this doesn't mean we can't go back and look at the problems that we can point out. Does anybody have any more questions, Chief Bartlett? We appreciate your interest in looking this over.
Thank you so much for coming.
Okay, then let's turn to page 50. Kidnapping. Barry, did you want to just, on the assault charge, why don't we just hand that out for people to look at?
Yeah.
And we won't go into that today unless we get done with this, but it'll give people, everybody, it's what we had in the blackboard, worked out one more.
Yeah, I'm going to try to make up charts like this for any type of, for all discussions involving
Mr. Chairman, apparently the senators are dealing with our oil gas again, which is why we're without senators. Senator Rowe, you had to leave the Puerto Rican Commission for the same reason.
I think we'll just proceed along with that one, I guess.
There's a chart that I made up for kidnapping. It's probably the best way to go about discussing the whole area.
Grand plan on how to successfully kidnap somebody.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Is there any idea, we're getting into regularly as we go through these, A felony, B felony, C felony. Is there any way, I know you haven't got recommendations on what the sentence structure is, but we don't really have any idea what we're talking about between A, B, and C.
You mean in terms of penalties?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Is there any way that we might...
You could just take something. Well, we could give you some examples of like what other states have done and what some of the proposals we looked at. What it was like...
Oregon, I believe, was 15, 10, and 5, but I won't swear on that. I can check in a second. New York was...
Well, your C felony is going to be over 1 year.
Uh-huh.
A minimum of over 1 year. Or the maximum would be over 1 year to be a felony.
We were talking, I think, at least of having three,
Just so I can get a ballpark idea.
And like with the two misdemeanors, you're probably looking at something like the any misdemeanor would be, you know, say like 30 days to 1 year,
mm-hmm.
or 0 to 1 year, and the B misdemeanor would be like up to 30 days or up to 90 days.
Yeah, there's some question about that. I think it was 90 days they were talking about.
And then, so an A felony would be like 15 years plus?
No, 15 years maximum. 0 to 15.
0 to 15.
If you're going on a theory where it was just an open sentence, you know, not presumptive sentence.
Yeah. So I have an idea. What
right.
It would be
like 15, 10, 5. Something similar to that. The states, we looked actually vary quite a bit in terms of of them have the 1 or 0 year minimum. But as Fred pointed out, with our existing statutes, that's in effect what we have, even though it says 5 to 15. In practice, it really means 0 to 15. Okay, Barry, do you want to go ahead and explain the chart?
Yeah. In the kidnapping and related offenses article, there are three offenses that involve interference with someone's liberty. Kidnapping, custodial interference, unlawful imprisonment. And they range from an A felony to a B misdemeanor. So they go the entire spectrum of offenses. Each one is broken down into 2 degrees. And you have the basic offenses described in the second degree category, with certain aggravating factors moving it into a first degree category. I should, however, point out that for kidnapping, the A and B felonies there, is, as far as I can determine, virtually every kidnapping will be an A felony. The B felony will cover the type of situation where there is no, where a specific intent is not listed. And probably the best way to begin, at least for kidnapping, is to go into the book on page 52 for the crime. Kidnapping is defined as the abduction of a person with intent to, and then there's 6 separate intents. Now the key word here is abduction, and that is defined on page 56 to mean restraint plus an intent to prevent the victim's liberation by secreting or holding him in a place where he's not likely to be found, or using or threatening to use deadly physical force. Now, restraint is defined also in that section, and that means to restrict a person's movements substantially so as to interfere, to restrict a person's movements unlawfully and without consent so as to interfere substantially with his liberty. Now, if you just have a restraint, in other words, if you've restricted the person's movements unlawfully and without consent so as to interfere substantially with his liberty, and there is not the aggravating factors present in the definition of abduct on page 56, which is secreting or holding him in a place where he's not likely to be found, or using or threatening to use deadly physical force, you won't have kidnapping. You'll have unlawful interference. Probably the best example is the situation where you're locking someone in a closet, for example. You say you're not leaving, but you're not threatening to use deadly physical force, and perhaps it's in the person's house, for example, and you're not secreting or holding him in a place where he's not likely to be found. Obviously, what you're trying to get at in kidnapping is the situation where you take someone for ransom, or you take someone to inflict some kind of injury upon him, and you're holding him someplace, again, where he's not likely to be located, or you're going to use deadly physical force. So, again, there are two key words here, abduct and restraint. If you just have restraint, which is interfering substantially with the person's liberty, you'll have unlawful imprisonment. If you have abduction, which is restraint plus the use of deadly physical force or hiding a person, basically, you're going to have kidnapping. Now, the other, so we have, those are the two broad offenses, kidnapping and unlawful imprisonment. The revised code has a separate section for custodial interference, because it was felt that when a relative interferes with the custody of a person that's related to him, it should not be viewed as either kidnapping or unlawful imprisonment, unless there's something very wrong. For example, the code recognizes that it's possible to kidnap a relative. It is possible to kidnap a relative, but in order to do so, you would have to have one of the intents listed in sections 1 through 6, which is hold him for ransom, use him as a shield or hostage, sexually assault him, interfere with the performance of a governmental function, and frankly, this is not going to be the typical custodial interference situation. It probably will never come about. So if you have a interference with custody rights, regardless of whether it's a child or an incompetent, the custodial interference section is broad enough to cover interference, say, with custody rights of a, regarding a mentally incapacitated person, for example. You'll have custodial interference. But it only applies if it's a relative that's doing the interfering. For example, I cannot go in and try to take from custody a child that is not related to me. That would be considered kidnapping or unlawful imprisonment. But however, if I am related to the victim, I can make the case that it's custodial interference. And currently we have a kidnapping statute and we have a custodial interference statute, except the fact that the kidnapping statute, well, the custodial interference statute is called child stealing, and it only covers interference with custody of children under 12 years of age. Now, we have a kidnapping statute that specifically exempts from its prohibitions the interference of custody of a minor with a minor. So based on my reading of the kidnapping and custodial interference statute, there's a significant loophole there in the sense that I seem to read that to mean that if you have a 12 to 18-year-old child and you interfere with their custody, you're not guilty of any offense. I haven't checked this out in terms of whether this, you know, whether this has ever come about, but based on my reading of those two statutes, it seems to exempt interfering with custody or kidnapping of a child who's 12 to 18 if the parent is involved. So if you abduct someone and with the intent to hold the person for a ransom, use them as a shield, inflict physical injury, place them in fear of being injured, or interfere with the performance of a governmental function, or facilitate the commission of a felony, you have committed kidnapping in the first degree, which is 1141-300. Now, the commission established an affirmative defense to this crime, and that recognizes that if the defendant voluntarily releases the victim without having caused a serious physical injury and without having sexually assaulted him, the defendant will be guilty of a B felony, will be guilty of kidnapping in the second degree as opposed to kidnapping in the first degree. And the intent of the commission in doing this was to recognize that in most kidnapping cases, probably the best evidence against the kidnapper would be the testimony of the victim. And we want to discourage any encouragement to the kidnapper that it might be better off to kill the victim. And we're trying to say, just don't kill the victim here. As a matter of fact, don't injure him seriously by this, and don't sexually assault him. So again, if the release is voluntary, and it certainly would not be a voluntary release, of course, if the police were closing in on the guy and he said, here's the victim, what we're talking about is on his own there before being captured. It would be a defense to first degree, but not a defense to second degree. Second-degree kidnapping is 1141-310, and that is just defined as the abduction of a person without one of those intents listed in the first-degree section. And it's important to note that this is only an intent to do this. You don't have to actually do it. In other words, if you take someone intending to hold them for ransom, regardless of whether you do it or not, you're still guilty of first-degree if you can prove that the person had that intent. And then kidnapping in the second degree there says it is affirmative defense that the defendant is a relative of the person abducted. The sole intent is to assume control of the person, and the abduction is not coupled with the intent to use or threaten to use deadly physical force or sexually assault the child. And what this is again doing is getting custodial interference outside of the kidnapping statute and into the custody statute. And again, it's important to note that this not only do you have to be a relative, but your sole intent is to be to assume control of that child. It can't be for another reason. Like, guy, I guess conceivably it could be to injure him, perhaps. Now, custodial interference here is 1141-320 and 330. The basic crime is defined in 330, second degree, and that was classified as an A misdemeanor. And person commits the crime of custodial interference in the second degree of knowing he has no legal right to do so. He takes, entices, or keeps a person from his lawful custodian with intent to hold him permanently or for a protracted period. Now, this is not, by having those words protracted period, you probably would not get hold a relative guilty of custodial interference if he maybe kept the child a day or two longer than is outlined in the custody decree. I don't think we would want, you know, I don't think the commission wanted to do that, and that's the typical language in these statutes, hold them permanently or for a protracted period, and that's going to be a jury question. And the term lawful custodian is defined in the definition section, and lawful custodian is defined to include, back on page 56, a parent, guardian, or other person responsible by authority of law for the care, custody, or control of another. And again, this person includes institutions, organizations within that definition. So it would cover, for example, interference with the interference with custody of a child, say, committed to API, perhaps. And it's not just limited to taking the child from the parent. Now, that's the basic offense. Now, it's raised the degree and it becomes a felony if the relative takes the person away from the state, takes him outside the state, or if he exposes the child or the incompetent person to a substantial risk of illness or physical injury, and that would make it a C felony. Unlawful imprisonment is 1141, 340, and 350, and it's defined in terms of restraining another person under circumstance. The basic offense, the second degree, is defined as restraining another person. And that's 1141, 350. And again, it recognizes that it's an affirmative defense that your relative, that your sole intent is to assume control of the child, and you're not intending to inflict, you're not intending to use deadly physical force or sexually assault the child or the victim. And again, this is trying to say that if you have interference with custody rights, it's not unlawful imprisonment, it's not kidnapping, it's custodial interference.
Barry, can I ask a question about Section 320? Why is it in the first degree, if you take a person from the state, why do you choose that particular degree of removableness? I mean, what if the person lives in Juneau and you take them to Barrow, he's much further away than out of the state.
But you're still under the jurisdiction of these courts. It's a lot easier to do something for the guy.
Yeah, I think for extradition purposes, it was put in terms of ensuring that you could extradite the person, because he would have committed a felony within the state. Although I don't know if we've ever really researched that issue, whether you don't have the right to extradite if the person's committed a misdemeanor.
Again, it's not a question of having the right.
Yeah.
Most jurisdictions, well, I don't know about most, but I've extradited a misdemeanor before, for example, in a series of serious fishing violations. But it usually takes a lot of convincing of another state's governor's office. It's generally a matter of policy. That there's a across the country reluctance to extradite on
I think what it is, I think it's what it's to do is to make it a felony, because custodial interference is an A misdemeanor, but if you take the person out of the state, it's going to become a felony, and therefore you won't have a problem with extradition.
It just simply makes retrieving the defendant easier.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe that was the intention. Well, your point is, I think, well taken in the sense that taking a person, say, 500 miles in Alaska or 1,000 miles might make it a more serious offense. The second...
Well, I understand that it simply makes it easier to get the
extradition
back.
Is a discretionary thing.
Yeah.
There's no... Alaska, for example, doesn't have any right enforceable in, say, the state of Washington to extradite someone who you charge with a crime. It's a matter of comity between governor's offices. And as a matter of practice, all governors will extradite on a felony. When you get into misdemeanors, it's been my experience that you get into an awful lot of questions about how appropriate the charge is and what's really involved and what's going to happen. And you get all kind of extraneous things involved in a decision.
Particularly if they go into Canada.
That's
only, like Lisa said, that's only 100 miles if you want to run to Canada.
Different set of problems. Different set of problems right there.
Yeah.
I should also point out that the other factor, there was one other factor singled out there, and that was exposing the person to a substantial risk of illness or physical injury.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Perhaps if you took the, I remember reading some commentary once, giving the example, you took the child and he needed medicine, for example, and as a result of taking him, you couldn't get the medicine, and it would make it a more serious offense.
Thank you.
Well, that covers the entire range of offenses in the in that chapter relating to interference with actual liberty in the sense of restraining a person. There's one other crime in this chapter, and it's called coercion. And it's similar to our existing blackmail statute in the sense that it covers a situation where you intimidate a person to do something when that person has a legal right to abstain. Legal right not to do it, or you compel a person not to do something which he has a legal right to do. And there are 10 threats basically listed here on pages 54 through 55 where you make a, you tell a person, I want you to do this. If not, I will do the following. And there are 10 things listed. Now, most of these, this is identical to the listing which appears in the theft section dealing with theft by extortion. And let me talk about that now, even though it's somewhat out of place. If you obtain property from another by threatening him with a certain type of harm, for example, I will cause physical injury to you, I will damage your property, I will charge you with a criminal offense, for example, and you obtain property, it's called theft by extortion. And it's treated more severely than just obtaining property from the person, for example, stealing from him. And so if you obtain property as a result of a threat, you're going to be guilty of theft by extortion. This section covers activity where you don't obtain property. You just merely have the person do something or not do something, which he has a legal right to do or a legal right not to do. And those 10 listings there are basically taken from the existing extortion statute, which is in the back of the book. And I would prefer not to go into detail with each specific one. I mean, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but we will consider that same listing when we do theft by extortion. But there are 10 listings, and frankly, it's very broad, because if you look at number 10, after listing all those specific ones, it says, inflict any other harm which would not benefit the person making the threat.
It's pretty general.
So it's a very general one, and it basically covers any type of threat that would not benefit the person making the threat.
It's a good thing the caucus is exempt.
I was going to say, you know, I think 1141-368, 1, 6, 8, and 10, if passed, would make it impossible to carry on the business of the legislature.
Well, this is in the existing.
How about 6? Intending to subject any person to hatred.
No, I included that piece. I was just thinking about Bill Ray. God, we got 4 counts against him already here. I got a senator threatened to punch me out in the legislative lounge in the first session for not signing a free conference committee report.
This was a.
Pretty soon you'll be protected under the law. We just hurry this along and get it passed.
It's a misdemeanor.
Oh.
Of course, our business legislative privilege. And
just have to make that a felony.
Sure.
There's a provision in C which recognizes that it's a peculiar thing. It's in existing law which recognizes that if you threatening to charge a person with a crime, it's a defense that the person making the threat reasonably believed the charge to be true, and his sole intent was to compel or induce the victim to take reasonable action to correct the wrong which is the subject of the threat and charge. Mm-hmm. And in the commentary there, I gave the example of someone just vandalized your fence, for example, in your house, and you said to him, okay, I want you to paint this or I'm going to call the cops on you, basically. And this is saying that that's not coercion, that you have a legal right to do that. The blackmail statute is certainly more limited, and that's on page 106. It's you know, I was just looking at this before the meeting, reviewing it again, and The blackmail statute covers when you threat an injury to the person or property of another, or to the person and property of a person standing in the relationship of parent or child, husband or wife, or sister or brother. But if, again, it excludes any other people that you might stand in a relationship to. For example, your grandmother. I mean, I don't want to bring that one up again, but I mean, it's a bit funny. That's the existing blackmail statute?
Yeah.
Yeah, 1115-300.
This may be otherwise cited. It's the Grandmother Criminal Relief Act.
Yeah, well, we're trying to protect grandmothers on this.
For Charles Colson.
Yeah, well, the new draft would cover a threat against one's mistress, and the old one would not. That's modern code drafting, if I ever heard it.
It would cover a threat to anyone, to any person. I mean, if you're threatening to cause physical injury to any person, it's sufficient as a threat. If I'm threatening to, if I want Dan to do something here, and I said, if you don't do it, I'm going to injure Terry, that's sufficient, even though Terry does not.
Don't threaten that you're going to injure me, or, you know, you may wait for his reward immediately.
Well, for now, I'll use A and B. But that's the kidnapping-related offenses article.
What was wrong with the old section? Without going into the section, the sentence by sentence.
The old blackmail section?
Yeah.
Okay. Number one, the old blackmail, the existing blackmail statute would be more limited here than say, okay, you have extortion, for example. You have the extortion statute, and it lists 8 or 9 threats in existing law. And it seems that there should be some parallel if you say that if you obtain property from another by making a threat against the person, then why shouldn't it be a crime if you don't obtain property necessarily, but you have that person engage in an act? So it's trying to just parallel the two situations together, saying that a threat that it obtains property is just as bad as a threat that causes a person to do something which he doesn't have to do, or prevents him from doing something that he has the right to do.
That threat to expose publicly,
yeah,
that's covered in there.
It's also covered in the existing extortion statute.
Is it in the new one?
Yeah. Everything that is covered here in the coercion statute parallels the extortion statute. It's virtually identical, except it does not require the property to be obtained. It's just an act, any act. And also, in response to Representative Brown's question, my reading of the blackmail statute only covers forcing a person to engage in conduct that he has a legal right not to do. It doesn't cover the situation where you force him not to engage in conduct that he has a legal right to do. The blackmail statute requires him to act affirmatively, whereas this covers affirmative and negative acts. So there was one point when this was discussed, I was not the reporter here during this, when this topic was brought up. I have reviewed it, and I've written the commentary, and I'm responsible for that. There is some question Dan just has brought up to me a number of times regarding the penalties that are for some of these offenses. I can only go by the printed material, and the coercion, for example, it was an A misdemeanor in that material. I wasn't at that meeting, and Dan might have a different recollection of it. And maybe also for kidnapping.
Is that something you want to go into this time, Mr. Chairman?
What I want to do when we're going through this is just to bring up any issues, and then we can come back and try to resolve them.
Well, at the next subcommittee meeting, on the 56th, let me just say here that I intend to raise that kind of an issue on the classification of a couple of these offenses that appeared in that original preliminary draft. I raised it the last meeting. Mr. Stern wasn't the reporter at that time. It was his understanding that since it was in the printed book, that's what the subcommittee had decided. And my recollection is that it was simply that printed book as an original matter was simply what was proposed, and that the subcommittee deferred the question of classification until it dealt with the majority of substantive offenses. And my view is that really this, the classification of coercion as a Class A misdemeanor here was one that was only dealt with by the by the subcommittee, and I have some question about that. It seems to me that it's improperly classified.
Well, what point do we bring up with improper?
I think it ought to be felony.
Would, shouldn't some of them be and some of them not be?
That may be a good point.
Well, that was brought up in the commentary in terms of saying, should this be a felony? You see, first of all, this wasn't in the preliminary report. It was in handouts. It was never. I don't think kidnapping was ever contained in the preliminary report. But the commentary to this, when it was discussed, indicated that some states have classified some threats as felonies and some threats as misdemeanors. And the commentary did cite the Michigan commentary saying that it's better just to classify everything as an A misdemeanor rather than try to distinguish between the two. And
on theft by extortion, is the current draft have it all run out?
No. Theft by extortion is a, okay, just as a preview, when we did our theft offenses, we made 3 degrees depending on the value of the property. But when theft by extortion is obtained, I believe it's a B felony or no, regardless of how much property is obtained.
That's right. And we're basically talking about the same level of conduct involving things other than theft. And it's conceivable that you would have an offense committed under here that would involve a much more serious or egregious offense than a theft by extortion would involve if it was for a small amount. I think it's a potential problem, and it's something I think we're going to have to re-examine the next subcommission meeting.
Okay, Dan, is your point that you're saying coercion should be a C felony?
I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, that at least some of the types of threats that are covered here, should for sure be at least a C felony, rather than across the board a misdemeanor. From a prosecutorial point of view, I think the entire section should be a C felony. But I can recognize arguments in favor of some of them being listed as an A misdemeanor.
Okay, are extortion and blackmail now 5 years, 6 months?
Our blackmail statute is confusing because it has that old language about if it's punishable by imprisonment in jail, it's up to a year, which is old junk out of places like Ohio.
We refer to jails and we don't.
The statute says if you put a guy in the penitentiary, it's up to 5 years. If you put him in jail, it's up to a year, which means it's a mixed bag, misdemeanor and felony. And it's ridiculous. It raises constitutional questions that on it. We have it on other statutes, and we got a couple of them that are being litigated right now. But, for example, in California, under their present penal code, if for a felony offense, a judge sentences an individual to county jail time, which means he can sentence him up to 1 year, the offense becomes, by definition, a misdemeanor. So if a person commits a burglary that's punishable by, say, 1 to 10, which is a California indeterminate sentence, the judge can do one of two things, basically, in terms of giving him a sentence of imprisonment. He can say, I sentence you to 1 to 10 years, or I sentence you to 60 days in the county jail. If he does that, if he says 60 days in the county jail or anything up to a year, it becomes, by definition, a misdemeanor. Because by law, misdemeanor is defined as anything with a sentence of 1 year or less. So our present statute is confusing. My view of it is that it would always be charged as a felony. If I charge the blackmail offense in the state, I charge it as a felony in the Superior Court, and it would be punishable by up to 5 years.
How much blackmail cases do you actually get?
I don't know of one.
Yeah.
It's obviously a very rare case.
You know, in terms of where we were on the subcommission on this in September, I brought up the entire kidnapping issue again in terms of some questions I had with it, and at that meeting it was decided.
It was decided.
Yeah, and you know that we had decided those issues.
Well,
I guess it's.
Well, the object, of course, of the legislature we're dealing with is just to try to review it and come up with the best possible statute. So, you know, I think. Here, even though I'm a member of the commission, to take the position that any comment that anybody brings before the legislature, that's what we're here for. What if somebody writes a letter or somebody testifies or is a member of the commission or whatever? And, you know, that doesn't mean I think we ought to go do the whole thing over, but certainly if somebody wants to bring up a question, we can look at it. But is that the only one, Dan, that you thought was in terms of the penalty?
Well, the only other question, of course, is the one that's reserved from the last meeting, which is the whole thing about Class A felonies and the fact that there are a couple like kidnapping in the first degree that depending on what the penalty structure is that's ultimately adopted for a Class A felony, we may be substantially changing the present penalty structure. And we've got a couple of offenses that are particularly egregious, such as kidnapping is a good example. And we've got what I guess you can refer to as an aggravated A, a super A.
Yeah, in sense of murder being an unclassified felony, I think what Dan is essentially saying is having maybe more than murder is unclassified, kidnapping perhaps.
Your counsel?
Yeah.
I've got a call into Mike Miller to call me as soon as he gets to the room. The Senate's still in session.
Right, I'm supposed to be in the governor's office too, so I'll be from there now.
Okay.
Yeah, in terms of that, I think I'd like to just take that issue up under sentencing since we want to get there.
That raises the question. I've never followed any of the sentencing debates that have gone on last year and this year. But would that come under the final adoption of the code, or
yeah, it would be part of it.
So we that there will be a sentencing section for the sentences for all of these.
I practice.
The thing is, on the sentencing, it's fairly simple to go back once you have all the crimes listed out, adopt any theory you can dream of 20 crimes or whatever, and then you just, it's very simple with the revised code because you can go back and it's all just laid out there.
You have a formula you've got.
You can get a very logical breakdown because you can, you start seeing, look, all these offenses are of the same seriousness, you know, which is just a value judgment that a layman, a lawyer, and judges are all equal in making.
You can say, here's murder, here's a Class A felony, and a whole family of those, Class B felony, Class C felony.
And then you can put whatever, you know, and whether you make something a Class A or Class B felony, to a lot of people, would depend on how many years you were talking about.
And there's even qualifiers you can put in, which I understand people are discussing in current drafts of sentencing bills, for instance. I've been mentioned a Class B felony not involving the use of a gun or physical violence. So, you know, rather than having to have this great big long laundry list of, you know, shooting your grandmother at 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
Yeah, I think the important thing though is that with this type of code, with the degree structure, you can, just plug it in.
Dan, let me ask you one question. If what you're saying is that you think in the way we've got coercion drafted that some of it is would be felony conduct, some would be misdemeanor conduct, how would you break it out?
I gave examples actually in the back of the book.
In terms of drafting, how would you break it out?
Well, I gave examples here in the sense that the model penal code attempts to measure the gravity of the defendant's misconduct on the basis of whether the threat is to commit a felony or the actor's purpose is felonious. In other words, if you could say that the threat is a felony or his intent is a felony, he's guilty, say, of a felony. And you would just draft it that way. New York says the offense is a felony depending on the kind of threat specified or the kind of conduct which compels the victim to perform. I think from a drafting point of view, it's not that difficult. I guess the difficulty is deciding which threats are aggravated.
Mm-hmm. If you want my off the top of my head, running through the list, I can do that. If you want that for the record.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't you submit a proposal? It'd be easier for the committee to consider. Okay. And then you could check with Barry and have a draft.
Using the same homogeneous, brilliant, modern drafting style.
We're going to go back to using unlawfully and knowingly.
Okay, well that about takes us through. Is there other questions? You want everything to be a felony.
A black and depraved heart.
Chairman, if you're finished with kidnapping, there was one point I wanted to make with assault that I didn't have a chance to make last time.
Okay.
And I made reference to it, but I just want to stress it here, that for purposes of the assault statute, we define serious physical injury to include conduct which unlawfully terminates pregnancy. And this is to cover, it does not cover abortions. What it covers is conduct, for example, where you recall, we talk about reckless assaults, negligent assaults. Say you have a case where a drunk driver is involved in a car accident, and the woman is pregnant, and as a result of the car accident, the pregnancy is terminated. We've just recognized that that would be a aggravated form of assault. The termination of pregnancy through that type of conduct would be a form of serious physical injury and consequently an aggravated form of assault. And in the homicide statutes dealing with that, we specifically said that abortion is excluded from the homicide provisions because the definition of person requires the person to be born alive, and consequently it's treated as assault. And we think, the commission thinks, that this provides greater protection to the mom, to the mother, because under existing law, there, I think it's a real issue whether, if the only injury is the termination of her pregnancy, whether that is an aggravated form of assault. And under the code, it specifically is.
What if the child is born alive during an abortion, or is aborted alive? I mean, it's an intentional abortion being carried out.
The code.
The fetus is breathing.
The code commentary states that whether an abortion is criminal or not is determined by the existing abortion statute, and we didn't attempt to change the existing abortion statute. I didn't. Unfortunately, I didn't give you that in the book.
Well, it's
not
in
the book. Yeah. Abortion in this section means an operation or procedure to terminate the pregnancy of a non-viable fetus. And then it says no abortion may be performed unless, and then it lists the circumstances. You know, if it's born alive, I think it's probably an illegal abortion under those standards.
Is there a time limit?
Not specifically in that statute, and I don't know where the time limit comes in. Although I do know that the Supreme Court had, in their opinion, you know, specifically saying that the state could prohibit it within a certain time.
I don't know what the
answer is. Yeah, I don't know where that is too. But I mean, the intent is to cover. The commission is only considering the conduct of assault. An assault which results in the termination of a pregnancy, not an abortion. That's left to existing law. There was just a recent case like that in Massachusetts, and the issue there was not resolved. It was never really resolved in that case. But the manslaughter conviction.
No,
the issue there was homicide, and the doctor was convicted of manslaughter, and that was thrown out at the Supreme Court level. But it wasn't really exactly clear why they would throw it out. That issue would never resolve.
Is there any further questions?
Well, tomorrow we'll go on to sexual offense.
I'll try to find that copy of the letter. I got from Jack Professor. Yeah. But I think, because I glanced at it, I think